You are listening to a free version of Majority Report with Sam Steeder. To support this show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder.
The destiny of America is always safer in the hands of the people than in the conference rooms of any elite.
Sam Steeder.
They are unanimous in their hate for me, and I welcome their hatred.
We must guard against the acquisition of unwarranted influence, whether sought or unsought, by the military-industrial complex.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder.
If I get the feeling you've been cheated.
It is Wednesday, November 12, 2014. My name is Sam Steeder. This is the three-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live, not in the literal nor never having been in the metaphorical shadow of the New York Times in the fashionable dull lunch district of New York City, but instead from sunny downtown Brooklyn. I've got to set a deadline. It's the one I'm going to come up with a new opening, but I never remember that I need one until literally 12:02 every day. On the program today, Ian Millhiser from the Center for American Progress on King v. Burwell. I've talked about this case a lot, folks, but this could be the most important thing that happens, well, not just this year. Also on the program today, speaking of game changer, President Obama apparently wearing that unidentifiable traditional Chinese tunic brought about a game-changing climate change pact with China. Talk more about that on the program. Also, Senate Dems, what can they do to put a cherry on top of the horrible midterm elections? I think they know. Vote for Keystone XL to help Mary Landrieu not win anyways in Louisiana. And also on the program, Glenn Beck. That's all. That's all I'm going to say about that. Yes, ladies and gentlemen, I am sick. I don't know if that's apparent. Back in the day, and I actually think it was right around the time that my daughter was at my son's age. This was now, I think, eight years ago. When Mila was a year and a half old or so, she started getting her colds and giving them to me. And that's basically the way it works. Although now it seems to be that Saul gives his cold to Mila, then Mila gives it to me. So excuse my lack of energy today, folks. But if you do want to put a little spring in my step, there's nothing that raises my spirits more than finding out that a bunch of people have joined as members. It is our members who make our show possible. Become a member today at jointhemajorityreport.com or head over to majority.fm. Become a member. You can also support this program. If you buy crap from Amazon, buy it from our Amazon link at majorityreportkickback.com. You will notice no difference whatsoever, but we get a little bit of a kickback. Also, justcoffee.coop, fair trade coffee, tea, or chocolate. Use the coupon code MAJORITY, get 10% off. Makes a great Thanksgiving gift and Christmas gift. Fund the war on Christmas, folks, buy your Majority Report coffee today at justcoffee.coop. All right, we're going to take a quick break. When we come back, Ian Millhiser.
Mm-hmm.
We are back, Sam Cedar on the Majority Report on the phone. Ladies and gentlemen, it's a pleasure to welcome back to the program the justice editor for Think Progress and the author of the forthcoming Injustices, the Supreme Court's History of Comforting the Comfortable and Afflicting the Afflicted, coming out in March of 2015. And Ian, it's as if really the Supreme Court is now functioning exclusively to make sure that your book is as poignant and relevant as possible.
As it turns out, there are five justices who want to make sure I sell as many copies as I possibly can. When I set out to write a really depressing book about the Supreme Court, I wasn't expecting them to make it even more depressing than what I wound up writing.
And it's quite possible that this King versus Burwell will be ruled upon right around that time.
That's right. So, I mean, we're probably looking a little later than the book comes out. The decision in King's probably going to come down in June. And the issue here is it could destroy much of the Affordable Care Act. It could defund much of it. And because of the way the insurance markets work, if you defund the subsidies that the Affordable Care Act provides, many insurance markets in many states will just simply collapse, and people who right now are desperately relying upon the insurance they got through the Affordable Care Act to continue their lives will not be able to get insurance at any price once those markets collapse.
Let's get to the ramifications in a second, but I want to read something that you, in fact, wrote in September. You were doing a preview of potential cases in front of the Supreme Court, or ones that you knew. At the end of the piece, you wrote, "Finally, there's a small but not zero chance that the justices could take a lawsuit seeking to gut the Affordable Care Act by cutting off subsidies to millions of Americans who currently enjoy subsidized health insurance under the law." This is a reference to either a Halbig, but specifically King versus Burwell. "It would be highly unusual for the justices to take this case, as there's not currently a disagreement among the lower federal courts regarding whether the subsidies may be paid to all Americans who qualify. However, given the extraordinarily partisan environment surrounding all things Obamacare, it is possible that four of the court's Republican members, and it only takes four votes for the court to take up a case, could allow their desire to undermine this law to cloud their legal judgment. Nevertheless, such a decision would open the justices to legitimate concerns that they are placing politics before the law and potentially diminish the prestige of an institution which depends upon its reputation as a neutral arbiter of the law to maintain its legitimacy." That day just happened a couple of days ago, didn't it?
It did. They just took this case, and, you know, as I wrote back then, it's very surprising. You know, there were none of the typical indicia for why the court generally decides to take a case. You know, what you did have is you had a statement actually from the plaintiff's lawyer. The lawyer who's suing to try to gut Obamacare here is a very conservative lawyer named Michael Carvin, a very good but very conservative lawyer named Michael Carvin. And he was interviewed by a reporter a while back, and he said he thinks he's going to win because the Republican appointees on all courts, but including on the Supreme Court, just aren't going to agree with the Obama appointees. Those were his words, with the Obama appointees who want to uphold the law. So he sees this in a very partisan way. He doesn't have very strong legal arguments. He actually has terrible legal arguments in this case. But he does have the force of this incredible Republican outrage towards all things involving the Affordable Care Act. As it turns out, there's five Republicans on the Supreme Court and only four Democrats.
And so, all right, so let's walk us through this case. You have a great piece out. I think it was out today.
That's right.
A non-lawyer's guide to the latest Supreme Court case. And I want you to walk us through this piece because it really is reminiscent of my days as a first-year law student, and I never had any second-year law student days. So, and the upshot of this is you get a taste of law school without actually having to go or to be a lawyer. So let's – I mean – take us through this. What does the case ostensibly hang on? And then take us through how a Congress has an ability to define anything as they want to.
Sure. So what this case is about is the Affordable Care Act gives every state government a choice. The state can either choose that it wants to set up its own health care exchange, and that'll be the marketplace where people get to buy Obamacare insurance plans, and it's the place where if they qualify, they can get subsidies to help them pay for it. They have a choice where they can set that exchange up themselves, or they can let the federal government do it for them. And the intention of Congress was that there really wouldn't be a difference between the state-run exchange and the federally run ones. In both cases, the subsidies would exist. The plaintiffs fixate on five words in the statute. Those five words suggest that subsidies shall only be available to people who are enrolled in a health plan purchase, and these are the words, through an exchange established by the state.
Well, that's open and shut. That's an open
right,
and shut
yeah. So
case.
Yeah, if you just read those five words, you think, oh, God, the government's got to lose this. Obviously, it's the case that, you know, an exchange established by the state is not an exchange established by the federal government, and that's the end of it. The problem is that there's actually a whole lot more than five words in the law. And one set of one provision that also exists in the law is there's another provision, and I'll just read the statute. It says an exchange shall be a government agency or nonprofit entity that is established by a state. So any exchange, as the word exchange is defined in the statute, shall be defined as established by a state. Now, this is a weird thing that legislators do when they draft statutes, is they'll use one set of words that seems to mean one thing, and then elsewhere in the law they'll define those words that they actually mean something else. In my piece, I give an example of a hypothetical statute that defines the word dog to mean cat. And if Congress writes a law that defines the word dog to mean cat, then when a court's reading that law, every time they see the word dog, they have to substitute cat, because that's what Congress has told them to do. The same thing's true here. You know, it's used these five words, it's defined them in a way that, you know, may seem a little odd, but they have the ability to do that. And so the fundamental issue in this case is whether the justices on the Supreme Court are capable of reading more than one sentence. Because if they can read two sentences, the government wins, and it isn't even a tough case.
And I mean, this isn't just about, you know, like, you know, we hear some we hear justices talk about being textualists in the context of the Constitution. But this is, I mean, when you're – this is about interpreting a statute, right? This is not about the Constitution. This is in some ways almost like interpreting a contract too.
That's right. I mean, you know, people throw around this word textualism. I consider myself a textualist. A textualist is someone who believes that the words of the Constitution and the words of a law matter, and you should follow what those words say. You know, my argument, the government's argument, is just you've got to read the whole law. You can't just read five words and rely on those. And so taking a textualist approach, saying the only thing that matters here is the words that Congress put on paper, it is absolutely, positively clear that the law is intended to give subsidies to everyone who qualifies in all 50 states, not just to the people in states that where the state opted to build its own exchange. That is in the law, and the only thing you need to do to get that, like I said, is to read two sentences.
And then even if you go further and you're not a textualist, right, you just look at the totality of what the intent of the law was, it's even more impossible at that point, right, to presume that that Congress meant for it to be the case that federal exchanges would not be provided subsidies, because that's like saying, you know, I mean, that's basically the fuel that runs those things.
No, that's exactly right. You know, the plaintiff's theory in this case is that Congress meant to give Rick Perry a red destruct button that he could push to blow up Obamacare in his state, and that they meant to pass out 50 of those buttons and give one to every single governor across the country. You know, that's not what Congress intended to do. What happens if those subsidies go away? The way that the economics of the insurance market works is that you have to have a certain number of enough healthy people in the market, because the healthy people pay the premiums in, and then sicker people wind up using the money that's in the pool to fund their health care. If you don't have enough healthy people, there's not enough money in the insurance pool to fund its costs, so premiums have to go up. But what happens when premiums go up is that more healthy people are likely to say, you know what, I can't afford my insurance anymore, I'm going to drop it, which causes the premiums to go up even more. And this is called a death spiral, where people dropping out begets higher premiums, which causes more people to drop out, which causes even higher premiums, and so on and so forth. If you take away the subsidies, you set that death spiral in motion, because immediately after you take away the subsidies, premiums skyrocket. In Mississippi, the average premium, I'm not making this up, is going to go up 2,000% without the subsidies. So this is a road to kill the Obamacare exchanges in the states that will be impacted by this decision.
All right. Now, I mean, here's the weird part of this conversation now, right? We could start to talk about that if the five justices, and we have a good idea who those five justices would be, if mm-hmm. five justices decide that they're going to strike down subsidies, essentially, say that, you know, the law states that they're going to fine for the plaintiff, they're going to say that subsidies are essentially illegal in states that have a federal exchange. Let's hold off on the ramifications and what states could do to change that, and what the federal government or Congress could do to change that. But if they were being consistent, there's a whole raft of laws that they would have to revisit, right, to reinterpret. Because we also have things like there was a piece in Huffington Post where someone raised the notion of 501c4s, where the actual law says you have to be exclusively engaged in social welfare as opposed to primarily, and this is what the whole supposed IRS scandal, targeting conservative and liberal groups, was all around. And the IRS, because it's an executive agency, just interpreted exclusively as primarily. I mean, right, there would be a whole series of these things. But even having that conversation is sort of kabuki, isn't it? Because it seems like the Supreme Court is untethered from this type of examination.
Right. I mean, when you say, like, if the Supreme Court does something, it's going to create a bad precedent and that will lead to all sorts of terrible consequences down the road, what you're assuming is that precedent still matters. And what bothers me about this case, you know, Justice Scalia, no liberal he, is one of the court's most vocal spokespeople for the notion that you have to read a whole law. You can't just read one line out of context. You have to read the law holistically. He reiterated that point earlier this year in a case involving the Environmental Protection Agency. That's how much Scalia has cared about this point, that you have to read the whole law in the past, that he says it over and over again, even when it forces him to uphold an environmental regulation. He still claims to believe it. So if he walks back that principle now, if he says that, oh, no, I didn't actually mean that, we actually can take this one line out of context, the message that sends is that the rules don't apply to Obamacare. You know, the message that sends is that, you know, there's this whole breadth of law, and the court will apply this law except when they really don't like the statute, or where there's five justices who really don't like the statute that's involved. And that's a scary world to live in.
All right. So let's take for a moment, like, what do you suspect? I mean, I know that you Supreme Court watchers, you all get into secret rooms and talk to each other about what's really going on. What is going on? I mean, these four guys take and we know that it's four guys. We know who the four are, right? It is.
We're pretty sure. We can't know for certain.
Okay, but we all right. So we're vaguely guessing that it's Thomas and Scalito and Scalia and Kennedy, and they're trying to get Roberts on board with this. Is that? I mean, that's sort of what everyone assumes, correct?
Yeah, I mean, that's the most likely scenario. You know, Scalia, Thomas, Kennedy, and Alito were the four justices who said they wanted to repeal the entire Affordable Care Act, literally, like, undo the whole thing in 2012. So, you know, if they've already been willing to do that once, it's a pretty good sign that they're going to want to do harm to the law again. You know, what
do they think that Roberts will go with them this time? I mean, because this is sort of like you said, there was a zero. I mean, not a zero, but a very small chance that they would pick this up because it's sort of it's pretty naked when there is no real sort of typical reason for them to pick up a case that is not controversial, at least in terms of the circuit courts. So, I mean, do they think that they can get Roberts?
I mean, it's a good question. I think there's two ways to look at it. You know, one way is, yeah, maybe they're really emboldened because they think they do have him. You know, maybe they talked to him beforehand and he said that they already do have him. And, you know, that's terrible news for everyone if that's true. It's also possible, though, is, you know, here's the thing. Every day that the Affordable Care Act is in place, especially right now because we're about to enter an enrollment period, that means that more people get insurance. That means that more people come to get insurance that will literally save their lives. And, you know, if this lawsuit goes the wrong way, people will die who otherwise would have lived. Every single day it's in effect, there's millions of people who form a constituency for the law and will be more and more outraged if the law is struck down. So if I'm Alito and I want to kill the law, I may not know if I have Roberts or not, but what I do know is that every day I wait, it becomes harder and harder for Roberts to decide to kill the law. And so that's the optimistic take on what's going on here. The optimistic take is not that the conservatives know that they've got the five votes they need to kill the law. It's that they know that every minute they wait, it gets harder and harder for them to kill it. So they better take it as soon as possible, because if they don't, then, you know, it's more likely that the law will survive.
So it could be essentially just a Hail Mary.
It could be a Hail Mary, and I'm hoping that they're just throwing a Hail Mary here. Because, again, you know, this isn't just a terrible distortion of the law if this goes the wrong way. And it's not just that, you know, it'll be a terrible political defeat. You know, if this law goes down, you know, I did a piece about this woman named Jennifer. She's a double lung transplant patient. She has to take very, very expensive anti-rejection drugs, and she needs insurance to pay for those drugs, or her body will reject the lungs and she'll die. You know, there was a piece by a liver transplant patient in the Washington Post that I think everyone should read. There's an amicus brief that's going to be submitted in this case on behalf of several individuals who have pre-existing conditions that need their insurance in order to live in many cases. And they're just heartbreaking stories. You know, there's a family that the gentleman had worked as a chemist his entire career. He'd done everything right. He was, you know, chemists are not people who live in the margins of society. They're people who have gotten an education and, you know, are fairly comfortable. And then he was diagnosed with prostate cancer, and then he was laid off. And what happened was, because he didn't have insurance, he had to pay $2,500 a shot for routine treatments that would keep his condition at bay. I think he burned through 3/4 of his life savings that he was counting on to retire. And this is someone who had done everything right. He was 59 years old, worked his entire life, and because Obamacare wasn't yet in effect, he burned through all those savings. Now he has insurance. Now he can continue to now he can get the treatments he needs. If this lawsuit goes the wrong way, what do you think is going to happen to him when his money runs out?
Let me ask you this. Yeah. We just have a couple minutes left, and these stories. I mean, this is, you know, I mean, the at least those four justices must have been aware, to the extent that they could be aware in the future or currently, they must have been aware of this when they tried to kill it the last time. Could this is a political question. At the very least, could, and I don't know how you get this past the House, but at the very least, you could pass it in the Senate, it seems to me, to pass a fix. Now, here's the question. You pass the fix now in the Senate. It's at least hanging there so that when this goes down, if the Supreme Court rules this way, at least from a political standpoint, Democrats can say there's been a fix waiting for 8 months on this. But if they pass a fix, could that be ammunition for the four or maybe the five to say, look, even Congress recognizes it made a mistake?
Right. Yeah, I mean, so here's the thing about it. The laws on the plaintiff's side are so weak right now that, like, it's not, you know, yes, there are things that could happen that the court will point to and say, because that happened, we're going to put that in our opinion to justify the result we want to reach. But that's what they'd be doing. The justices, if they rule against the subsidies, are going to have to construct from the ground up a rationale for what they want to do, because it's not in the law.
So, I mean, just lastly, they come to you and they say, look, we can get this passed in the Senate and lame duck. You, as an observer of the Supreme Court, would we be giving cover to them, or is that sort of moot? They're going to do what they're going to do.
I mean, I think they're probably going to do what they're going to do. You know, now that said, you know, what's the point of passing a fix when in the Senate, when the House won't let anything through
right.
that involves Obamacare?
Okay. Fair enough. Ian, they certainly are contemplating the success of your book, which will be coming out hopefully in March, Injustices, the Supreme Court's History of Comforting the Comfortable and Afflicting the Afflicted. I'm sure we will talk to you before then, but I appreciate your walking us through this.
Thank you, Sam. And I'll point out the book is available for pre-order. If you just Google my name and Injustices,
people won't have
up.
To do that. We will link to it directly from majority.fm.
Fantastic. Well, I appreciate that.
All right. Thank you, Ian. All right, folks. I just want to touch on it is. I mean, I think it was back in 2004. I can't remember exactly who we were talking to. I think it was Charles Ogletree, a law professor from Harvard, who I think is still there. And I was saying, how is it that you guys, you professors, constitutional law, or I should say Supreme Court watchers, how is it that you still maintain this pretense that the Supreme Court is legitimately taking up legal arguments? I mean, after Bush v. Gore, it seemed so apparent to me. And this is someone, you know, I'm saying this as someone who was raised to think that, like, you know, lawyers were the sort of the integrity pecking order, were above just about everybody. I mean, I was raised by literally a pack of lawyers. So it was like, if you're a lawyer, your responsibility to the law is above everything. And yes, well, that was the point. Yeah, Bush v. Gore was not only a ridiculous ruling, but they also sort of said, like, oh, and incidentally, this is a one-off. If we're ever in a position to change an election for someone we don't want to win, this would not be binding. And it was a joke. I mean, no legal expert prior to Bush v. Gore, that case, as it was winding through the state court, thought that the Supreme Court would take the case. Never mind rule in favor of George Bush, because it would be in some way, if the votes were counted, that it would some way prejudice his, what they were hoping would be his inevitable presidency. And yet they maintained a sense, and part of that I think was just like sort of 9/11. I have mentioned this many times on the program, but the Newsweek issue due to come out September 13th, 2001, was In fact, the cover was about the fissure in the Supreme Court. That it had sort of burst out into the open because there was an annual visit from Russians who would come and meet with the Supreme Court justices to find out how you create a rule of law in society. And that in the course of that, which happened, I think, over the course of the summer, there was a lot of rancor over the Bush v. Gore ruling. And there was, like, it seemed to me that the legal profession was in shock following the 2000 ruling. Just people were just like, how could the Supreme Court do this? And they were just sort of like coming out of shock by the end of the summer. And then, of course, 9/11 hit and it all got completely wiped away. I remember this because I was obsessed with the whole thing, and that's what drove me to write and shoot A Bad Situationist over that summer, which also by 9/11 or on 9/11 became a movie that was a huge mess on that day. But that's another story for another day. But we're going to take a break and head into the better half. But before we do, since we've been talking about Bush v. Gore, and we all know what the implications of Bush v. Gore were, that is, G.W. Bush, not to be confused with G.H.W. Bush. See, G.H.W. Bush was the first George Bush presidency, number 41. G.W. Bush was 43. G.W. Bush was the son of George Herbert Walker Bush. Now, I say this because some people think it's just a coincidence that they have the same last name. And they don't realize that George W. Bush was actually the son of George Herbert Walker Bush. And George Herbert Walker Bush was, of course, the son of Prescott Bush, who I believe was also a senator, I think from Connecticut. And then George Herbert Walker Bush was a congressman, I believe, from Texas, and then went on to be CIA director and then vice president and then president. And then George W. Bush, after he stopped drinking because he had a massive drinking problem, following his questionable service for the National Guard, following his getting into Harvard undergraduate and business school, not doing very well, sort of weird, following him being in Andover. Some people think it's a coincidence. Like, that guy, George W. Bush, who was president, the 43rd president. Here he is where he's telling Bob Schieffer that nothing's handed to you. Well, let's hear this.
So let's talk about the Bush dynasty here. Your mom says there have been enough Bushes running for president. What do you two think about that?
Sometimes her prognostications haven't been very accurate. And I think you have to earn your way into politics. I don't think that anything's ever given to you.
Nothing's ever. My mother's prognostications are sometimes, no, but seriously, nothing's ever given to you in politics. Now, on the other hand, like that time I got the oil company, that was given to me. I mean, let's not beat around the bush. And when I bought the, when I was given a big chunk of the Texas Rangers baseball team for about $15,000, that was given to me. Politics or not. I mean, of course, the governorship, that was more or less, I got a hand up, but once you're there, it's not, nobody gives you the job. In other words, you've got to show up and do the job at least every other day. So, for instance, in my situation, I had to Monday, Wednesday, Friday. If you can absorb how much pressure that must be to come in every single Monday, Wednesday, and Friday, except for, of course, you know, sometimes I had off. But you got to get there first thing in the morning on Wednesdays. Mondays, I would come in a little bit late because I had to come in late. And then Fridays, I would leave early. It's Friday. So, but Wednesdays, full day. Full 10 to 4 p.m. day as governor. So that was not handed to me. And then, of course, being president, let's put it this way. I had to go in there Monday, Wednesday, Friday, like clockwork. Specifically a clock that would skip every other day and start later on Mondays and end earlier on Fridays. But if it was just handed to you, then I think what you'd see is my brother, Jeb Bush, trying to be president. Well, okay. So he's trying. All right. We'll see if that gets handed to him. So, no, everything is super hard. I would never, ever been president if it had to be handed to me. In other words, you don't go from being a total lush who nobody has respect for to being president if it's just handed to you. You got to put in the hours. I mean, or some hours. So, take that, Bob. See you on the golf course. Snickerdoodles. That's what I'm calling you. New name, Snickerdoodles. Because you're like Bob Snickerdoodles. That's what it's going to be, Snickerdoodles. It's my new name for you. And that ability to give nicknames to anybody on the fly. Think that was given to me? No, that's something I had to work on. It's hard work. So, next question, please, Baba Sheen Snickerdoodleson.
Baba Sheen Snickerdoodles, wow.
Yeah, there you go. All right, folks, going to head into the funner half, although that was super fun. In the fun half, we're going to talk about Glenn Beck. Apparently, he has a rare neurological disease that has fortunately been cleared up by rest and diet and living in Texas. But nevertheless, he still may have to retire from a daily show within 3 to 7 years, 5 to 10 years. And I should also tell you folks that I also have a rare neurological disease that may also force me to retire if we get bought out for $300 million here. That's what my doctors say. It's very strange. You can help towards that goal. We are only several million memberships away from that day, ladies and gentlemen. You can become a member today at jointhemajorityreport.com or majority.fm. You can support the program by buying your crap from Amazon. If you buy it from Amazon, buy it through our link. No excuses at majorityreportkickback.com. Click on the Amazon link. Bookmark it. Always buy your crap through there. If you do it as a one-off, that's fine too. And justcoffee.coop, fair trade coffee, tea, or chocolate. Great coffee, great company. Win, win, win. Give it as a gift. Buy the Majority Report blend. Everybody wins. All right, we're going to take a break. 646-257-3920 is the number. 646-257-3920 is the number. We will be back in just a moment. You can IM me via the app at majorityapp.com. We'll be right back after this.
Apple Pay.